What would you do if someone you loved vanished and you discover the person she's been living with isn't who they said they were? I'm Dominique Baines, host of Expanse, the Nan Up 4.
Is he, you know, a murderer or a
self-styled cult leader?
It's just not knowing the emptiness, really, that just kills you.
This is the bizarre story of the Nan Up 4. Binge all episodes now. Search Expanse on ABC Listen and iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Annabelle here. If you're loving the stories of Australia's oldest library, join me and a special collection of librarians. What is that collective noun? Not sure. We'll be blowing the dust off more fascinating stories and quietly debating whether this is history or just exceptionally well-organised hoarding. That's History or Hoarding Live. Find the booking link in the show notes or on the State Library of New South Wales website. And now, it's on with the show. Hello, welcome back to History or Hoarding. I'm Annabelle Crabb. So up to now, we've been talking about stuff. The stuff we keep, the stuff that, after we die, tells a wonky, patchy, incomplete story of who we are and what we cared about. But the truth is that all these decisions are subjective. We know this from our own homes, where one party's treasure from grandma is the next person's hard rubbish pickup. When we're talking about national hoarding institutions, however, this question of subjectivity becomes even more relevant. Take Australia's oldest library, where every single thing in the collection made its way there because a human being put it there. Every book, every treasure, every trinket, every curio that will live on forever is the result of a library staff member who made a decision about what was worth protecting. And these people don't just shape what gets saved. They dictate how the rest of us find it and interact with it and remember it forever. And today we're going to meet two of those people, Melissa Jackson and Ronald Briggs. In the library, people call them the Giggle Twins. A magical pair of humans who have genuinely changed the way Australian libraries collect things. They met on the day they both showed up to work as cadets, 35 years ago.
So we walked through the doors in our 20s.
Mm-hmm. And you never escaped.
Never escaped. No, no, they're going to accession us and, you know, even we can't retire or anything like that. So we're going to have to live there for the rest of our lives. My name is Melissa Jackson. I work at the State Library of New South Wales in the Indigenous Engagement Branch. I'm the librarian within the branch, and I've been working at the library since December the 9th, 1991.
Okay. What about you?
My name is Ronald Briggs. I started the same day as Melissa, way back in 1991. I work as a librarian, but these days I'm working mostly in the curation exhibition side of work at the library, amongst other things, inter alia.
He's the clever one.
Okay, so a couple of things. Working in the same place for 34 years is very old school. It's also wild that you both started on the same day. Can you tell me the story of how that came to be? Did you already know each other?
No, we didn't know each other from a bar of soap. And so, however, my auntie knew you. And so I was studying to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I got to the end of my qualifications and realised I didn't like children.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I had to seek alternatives. Oh, my goodness, I've gone through this university, this trial of being a teacher. And my mother, who was in adult Aboriginal education, she had brought a group of her students into the library and was told that there was a cadetship going.
Right.
And so she harassed me into applying for the job. I didn't even know where the State Library of New South Wales was so I got the job. And I told my auntie, I've got the job. And she then went out one night and bumped into Ronald. And Ronald was going, I've applied for the job at the State Library. I hope I get it. And she's gone, you know, said to herself, honey, you didn't get the job because my niece got the job.
Okay. Right, and was just the two of you?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It was just the two of us, but we worked within a great team. I mean, we were put into into a really safe space in the library to begin with, right. I guess you could say that. And we were both young. I mean, I was only 22.
Ooh. And Melissa, you've just hopped off the train and gone, okay, just working out exactly where the library is.
Yeah. And so the State Library is in two buildings. So there's the glass building and then there's the historic building.
Yep.
So you go into this glass building for your induction.
Yeah.
And so up into the ivory tower to HR, fill in all the forms. And then we walked into the Mitchell Library reading room and it was huge and it just floored me. I felt so tiny.
It is an incredible space.
It's an amazing space. And so, you know, I was only going to be at the library for 3 months. And as soon as I saw that, it was just like, I found my spot. I found who I am.
Yeah, it's awe-inspiring. But at the same time, you think, oh, shit, what have I got myself into here? And
So why did they start calling you the Giggle Twins?
We were so loud. We were just always so loud. So talking so
in a library, mind you.
In a library?
Did you just get shushed all the time?
Oh, yeah.
Always.
Is that why they gave you your own section?
We were just two little young black kids in this big library running around, given the run of the place.
And then we were sort of, we came back to our desk and we had this beautiful mentor. Her name was Janice Robinson. And one day she said, please, can you be quiet just for a little while? I've tried going up into the reading room to do my work, but I work here too. So we just looked at one another.
We felt so bad after that. And we'd be like, just zipped our mouths. We were quiet for the rest of the year, I think. We didn't just, yeah. So,
yes. Surely passing notes is the library alternative.
Well, this is it. I mean, your proper library etiquette is to, you know, remain quiet and, you know, in hushed tones and all that sort of stuff. But here we are, two little black fellas, you know, from the bush. Oh, I was from the bush. And you know, given, oh, wow, look at all this. Yeah, Melissa, look at this. Melissa, oh, wow. You know,
what you do on the weekend. Yeah, man.
And it was the same because we would.
Oh, dancing with your auntie again.
Yeah. As we developed in our role, we would be inviting groups in to the library to come and have a look at this stuff that we found, and we'll come and have a look at this stuff that's about you. And we'd be in the reading room, you know, sitting around talking with people, showing them photos that they wouldn't necessarily have seen before. And, you know, we'd be laughing and you know, and saying, oh, Auntie Glennis, look, you know. and so eventually we had our own little corner. The family history corner became ours for a little while where we could take people and show them stuff. And
Were there egg cartons hammered onto the walls or anything?
Soundproof.
I think we should have at one stage. Well, now we've got our own room, which is good.
I'm starting to understand why. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was just how, I guess, that's just how we did it. That's how we wanted it to be. Mm. And, I mean, I think we definitely took it seriously when we first started. Mm-hmm. But we sort of knew in the back of our minds that, you know, we're just playing it by ear here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we're in totally new roles. So we were making it up as we were going along, pretending, I guess, some of the way that we knew what we were doing.
So what was this job? How was it advertised? Like what was the gig?
Well, it was a traineeship. As a librarian, which is how we used to do librarianship back in the day.
Yeah.
But these days it's unheard of. So we were studying to be librarians as we were working in a library, basically.
Right.
It was a wonderful opportunity. I mean, fantastic.
And was it a specific Aboriginal cadetship?
Yeah.
And why did they do that at that time, do you think?
I think after the 1988 bicentenary, a lot of people, particularly in libraries and academia, that, you know, in that world, recognised that there was a real lack of Aboriginal perspectives in these spaces, in spaces that talk about culture and history. And I think the bicentenary showed a lot of people who were interested in Australian history, well, what about the blackfellas? How are we telling our story?
Mm.
You know, and I think so our employment was part of the response to that.
Even though the library had good intentions about changing its relationship to Indigenous collections, Melissa and Ronald quickly confronted the gap between First Nations history and the white colonial version. The fascination in particular for some items in the collection seemed just weird.
I remember getting told the importance of the pictures of ships. in the library's collection.
Are there lots of ship pictures?
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Millions of photographs and drawings, paintings, illustrations, etchings, you name it, of ships. Because when you think about it, that's how a lot of people arrived in Australia, have a lot of people's families have arrived in Australia. Mm. So ships, the pictures of ships became particularly important in you know, Australian families' histories.
Not a request you get from Aboriginal families that much, right?
No. Well, and for me, it was like, oh, ships, more ships. And no, honestly, we had filing cabinets, about 7 or 8 filing cabinets, just full of ships' pictures that people could rifle through and find alphabetically the name of their ship. And they'd say, oh, I'm looking for a picture of the Albemarle. It arrived in 1883. Okay.
What's your interior monologue saying when somebody says the Albemarle?
Let me just grab the key to the cabinets and we'll come over and have a look. They're arranged alphabetically, you know.
And I couldn't tell you were being sarcastic there, Ronald. I
remember being told by a lecture, not, like I said, it wasn't actually a lecture, it was just a reminder of how important ships are to the library's collection. You don't think of them the right way, Ron. You should be thinking of them in this way. They're very important to the people that are living here now. And I did take it seriously. Yes, of course we should value these ships' pictures. They're very important to these people. I do respect that, you know, people have arrived in different ways in this country. These days, probably, you know, you'd probably get naturalisation papers and, or I don't know, whatever.
Qantas flight, blah, blah, blah.
Flight yeah. logs and, pictures of different airlines and that sort of thing. And I guess I was being rather blasé with people that were coming in looking at ships and stuff, but I was soon put on the right path of how to deal appropriately with an inquiry about ships.
Well done. As Melissa and Ronald settled into their jobs at the library, they discovered what was for them the most exciting part of the job, helping First Nations people piece together their stories.
I think a lot of the more rewarding moments that I've had relate to people who've seen a photograph for the first time of someone in their family. I remember sitting with a woman one day and she'd been living in Sydney. Her mum was taken away and was at Cootamundra Girls Home. Her mum never really got to know her own mother, who was from Menindee. And I was in looking one day with a woman and she was only in her early 20s, looking at photographs and going through what we call the Tyndale genealogies, who was an anthropologist who did lots of studies of communities in New South Wales in the late 1930s. So we were going through his photographs, and this young girl sitting next to me, I was just flicking through, she was flicking through, and the next thing I felt my arm being pulled off. And I looked at her and she was in tears. She said, "That's my grandmother. That's my grandmother." And it's the first time she'd actually seen a photograph of her grandmother.
How did she recognise her?
Well, she was named and she, and, you know, and she'd figured out in her mind, look, this is blah, blah, blah at Menindee in November 1938. There's only one woman with that name in Menindee in 1938. And she was crying and I almost started crying too. It was just that people visually seeing themselves in our collections is probably the most rewarding. Part of your role is to make sure that this information is collected, it's kept, but we're not hiding it away. We're making it available to people so that they can experience what we all want, which is reconnection or connection with our community, our people and our past.
Gosh, I mean, we've been talking all about how your job is to fill in gaps in the collection, right? Like that's why you were hired, one of the reasons why you were recruited to become librarians. But like you're also filling in gaps in people's lives too, right?
It sounds really corny, but we used to say a lot, you know, you can find yourself in the library. And you do, you really do. I remember when we were going through the old Tribune photographs, which are the photographs of the Communist Party of Australia.
Mm.
And we were fortunate enough to have donated to the library the archive from the Tribune newspaper, including all of their negatives. And the communists were involved in everything, basically, as ASIO will tell you.
Yeah.
So they were involved in lots of protest, in lots of social movements and political movements that were happening in Australia, you know, in the early part of the 20th century. And one of the things that they were involved with was the Freedom Ride.
Yeah.
Remember in 1965 when the students from Sydney University went throughout rural New South Wales to different towns protesting about segregation policies and racist, local governments and that sort of thing.
Charlie Perkins was
one of the leaders of that ride. And one of the places they went to was Moree, which is so happens to be where I'm from, you know, proud Kamilaroi fellow, Kamilaroi country, heart of Kamilaroi country, I might add.
Come on now.
Moree. And I remember, you know, sadly my dad's passed away now, but I remember him saying that whenever Charlie would be on TV, he'd say, "Oh, there's Charlie, me old mate," and that sort of thing. And he'd just say, "Ha ha, yeah, right, whatever, Dad." We were digitising the Tribune photographs and... I remember one day flicking through a newly set of digitized photographs of the Freedom Ride. I'm like, "Oh, wow, the Freedom Ride. Wow, I haven't seen these before." And I was flicking through the photo collection, and one of the photos, there's this little boy with his squints, you know, staring at the camera, you know, who's the main focus of the camera. Oh, my God, that's Dad.
I literally have goosebumps right now.
I know. And I just froze because it was my dad. As you know, this 13-year-old boy swimming, you know, in Moree swimming pool on the day that the Freedom Riders were there.
And he wasn't bullshitting you about knowing Charlie Perkins.
Me and Mrs. going, "Oh, he rolled the eyes, you know, yeah, whatever, Dad." But, yeah, it was actually Dad. So we've got this wonderful photo of Dad and his cousin, Sid, who sadly passed away just recently too, at Moree swimming pool on the day that the Freedom Riders were there. So Dad was one of the first Aboriginal kids to swim the Moree pool. There you go. And I've got proof now.
History maker, your dad. So it's just inadvertent things like that as well, the things that you bump into.
These little magical connections. Melissa, have you found yourself in the library?
No.
Oh, yes, you have.
Who? Where?
You're a Bundjalung girl. There's lots of Bundjalung stuff.
There's lots of Bundjalung stuff and there's some really hot Bundjalung men. And photos.
So this is personally a perving exercise for you. Well, that's lovely.
I shouldn't be confessing to this.
No, these are 34 well-spent years.
Yeah, but I haven't been able to find that one person just yet that's been me.
Though Melissa and Ronald have found joy in this job, they've also had to confront on a daily basis how their history for a really long time wasn't valued by institutions like the one in which they work every day.
Well, for example, you often think to yourself, why don't you just ask? You know, you had Ben Long there, he was living with you for 4 months, for God's sake. Why don't you just ask him? Well, Ben Long, what's your story? Who was your mother? What was she like? You know, doing oral history with Ben Long. That'd be lovely. Why didn't they?
Why didn't they just ask Ben Long?
Exactly.
But I mean, I'm interested in your theory as to that.
Maybe they did, and it hasn't survived. The record doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's, you know, more than 200 years ago. I mean, and that happens. You know, bushfires, floods, all that sort of stuff. Mm. You know, but why? Why wasn't more an active and systematic approach to recording that sort of information? And you have to think, well, that's not what they were here for.
Mm.
And they were here, and Aboriginal people were the other, and for a lot of people at that time, the enemy. So you didn't even want to talk with them about it.
As time went on, that overt hostility might have faded, but it got replaced by this hole in the library's collections where there should be Aboriginal stories.
Before the 1970s, a lot of Aboriginal people couldn't read and write. So, you know, and so they're not going to write it down. People say to me, well, why don't you have a collection from blah, 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 blah? Well, did you know that blah, blah, blah didn't go to school? And a lot of records that we have about that particular person written by other people. And you have to think, why? Why don't we have collections from, blah, blah, you know, this famous person? And that famous person probably wasn't as confident writing things down and or, you know, expressing in a room full of white fellas how it should be written or how it should be spoken. I mean, so having an oral history from those from the early period is really valuable in that regard because it's how from an Aboriginal person because it's how that Aboriginal person would have said it at the time rather than writing it down in words or in ways that you'll understand or like.
Over the course of our conversation, I've actually been wanting to ask you, how does oral history incorporate into an institution that was set up to collect paper where you literally measure your collections by the meter? Well, you can't measure oral history by the meter, right? And you can't yet download the contents of someone's head who's had knowledge passed down in a way that's not written.
Yes, a lot of historians tend to look at that type of research as being gossipy sometimes or being not as serious or relying on memory. So it's almost like saying it's only if it's written down if that it's valid, that it's real information.
Isn't that funny the way you think, well, if someone's told it to you, then it's sort of somehow subjective, it's not black and white, it's not... Most of what gets written down is exactly as fallible, right?
Yeah, that's what it is. What's written down is edited within an inch of its life.
Yeah.
The loss of information, the loss of knowledge through the loss of elders, loss of people is really acute.
I just know out there there's the undiscovered. And what I'm particularly interested in, undiscovered, that was collected or written or produced by the Aboriginal person involved. I guess just relating personally again, getting back to my dad, what if my dad had taken photos that day too? What if my dad, a few years later wrote a little poem or a book about it? That would be an absolute treasure. And I know that there are lots of those sorts of things out there that I do lie awake about, and think about, who's the best person to contact? Who might know about this? Who might know about that? And people have material in their possession they don't even know is significant.
Yeah.
Is really significant.
That's one of the things about what Ronald and I do is that we recognise that not everybody comes from Macquarie Street, and that we have to go out into community. So it's extremely important to have community knowledge kept within community.
Really, the digital age has changed everything. I remember, it would have been 10, 15 years ago, talking on a radio show about a new collection we had, blah, 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 going back to work. And then I get a phone call from an older woman in the community saying, oh, that's really great, Ron. Can you get me a copy of that, please? And, me stuck in the way thinking, an old woman living out in remote areas of the community, I'll make some photocopies, I'll take some photos, I'll put them in an envelope and send them out to her. She said, my daughter's email address is, so she just wanted me to take some photos right there and then and send it to her. Now it's just like click and, send it on your phone. It's just changed. It's a real game changer in the way that we're providing information. And we're not living in the Stone Age. In fact, Aboriginal people are probably a lot more advanced in with technology these days than people realise. It's just incredible. It's really good to see, though. The communities are taking the information from the library and making it their own and putting it up on their own websites and saying, this is how we want you to treat it. And that's, more power to us and them. Yep.
Okay, so if we're talking about change, 3.5 decades ago, perceptions around the bicentenary and the way that it was marked and talked about obviously spurred some discussion about what this conversation was missing. So I'd like to hear from each of you, when you look back on that bicentennial marking, what do you think we do differently and what you've learned over that journey?
I would say the biggest difference from what's happening now compared to when we started is that more Indigenous or First Nations people are writing about it. Are talking about it, are making films about it, and are doing it themselves. Blackfellas are doing it for themselves. We can tell our own story.
What do you think, Melissa?
From walking in the door 3 decades ago, it's a personal journey, I think. I have been humbled by community, like Ronald was saying, not going into community and saying, here's your history. I take in. I don't know everything, and that's one of the things that I've learned in the time that I've been at the library. I don't know everything, and I'm 60, and I'm still learning.
What happens when the two of you finally decide that it's time to stop walking through the front doors of the library every day?
I have no idea what I'm going to do.
Will you finish up on the last day? Are you going to, like, you know,
together,
Thelma and Louise it
that's
out of there?
We've already done a little bit of that this year. We went out to Broken Hill and Narromine and places that you only read about.
Yeah, we went on a holiday together.
Over time.
It was hilarious. It was so much fun.
But it was lots of fun. We'll probably do a little bit more of that, which I think Melissa wants to do some cruising. I'm not really into boats and cruising, but we'll do that, I guess.
Well, thank you for being a part of our tiny, amateurish oral history segment here today. It's just so lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Next time on History or Hoarding, the story of an irreplaceable item, one of the most important things in the library's collection, that slid down the wall and smashed. Surely everyone went running, to a certain extent.
We're not allowed to run.
We just have to take a deep breath and go, okay, how are we going to deal with this?
History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea. Harvey O'Sullivan is our audio engineer. Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer. And Carmel Rooney is our executive producer.